History can be oh so present or long forgotten. Stories can be buried deep, only to be dug up after decades, depending on who's searching. But can you really bury a colonial past? And what's the cost? This is African Roots, brought to you by DW. We discover how individuals from across Africa shaped the continent. I'm Kai Nebe.
And I'm Leila Johnson Salami.
Leila, have you ever been to central Nairobi?
No, I've actually never been to Kenya, even though I've always wanted to visit. Very noisy, I hear. A bit like Lagos.
Well, I've never been either, but I hear that in the center, just a few blocks from Uhuru Park, is a statue honoring a Kenyan freedom fighter who kind of was a forgotten man for decades.
I just know him as a freedom fighter. Just feel like we're honoring them and appreciating what they did for us.
For what I know, they fought for the independent. And then they were later killed by the colonial government.
And who would that be?
Dedan Kimathi. He's now recognized as one of the most important figures in Kenya's battle against colonial rule. Well, actually, he even served as an inspiration for other African liberation movements.
So then, why was he forgotten? Kenya gained independence in the 1960s, right?
We'll get to that. But first, a little background about Dedan Kimathi himself. He was born in 1920 in Nyeri, about 150 kilometers north of Nairobi, in the British colony of Kenya. He was born into a Kikuyu family, but his father died before he was born.
Oh, shame.
So, yeah, not a very easy start to life for young Dedan Kimathi. He also only started school age 15, which today we would consider super late, but at the time it was more common, you know. He joined the Church of Scotland Mission School. From what we know, Kimathi was a very intelligent student and especially good at English and debating. But he was also a rambunctious one. Some would even call him a troublemaker, which led him to being eventually expelled for indiscipline. He apparently even had a nickname, Leila. He was called Njangu, which means rough and treacherous.
So a bit of a rebel then.
Yes, and in his early working life, Kimathi kind of drifted from job to job. He could never stick anywhere. And he was basically never able to hold a job down for long.
The makings of a leader, I guess.
Well, it didn't look like it at that stage. But even though Kimathi was battling to find his place in Kenyan society, he had a very good understanding and command of English, which was the language of the colonizer Britain. And British control in Kenya was, to put it diplomatically and mildly, extremely controversial. Bluntly speaking, British control over Kenya, and especially over the Kikuyu, was unjust in the extreme, cruel and exploitative. Kenya's colonial history was a bit different to other African nations because white settlers came to stay. And in many ways, the highlands where most Kenyans lived was perfect for the white settlers. The region possessed some of the most fertile agricultural land in the entire world. The climate helped Europeans avoid succumbing to diseases present in the coastal regions. And there was plenty of labor to work the farms and the tea plantations that were soon grown. And the British colonialists were very quick to take over the land and exploit particularly indigenous Kikuyu labor.
That must have been horrible for indigenous Kenyans to live through.
Yes. And the colonial government became very efficient at maximizing profits. It even got to a point where dispossessed Kenyans even had to pay taxes to the colonial authorities. They could not farm food for themselves on the little land they had, and there was an overarching sense of racism and superiority that the white Kenyans felt over the Africans. In fact, even British politicians reckoned that the colonialists in Kenya were the most racist in the entire British Empire, which I guess tells you a lot.
Yeah, it does. But how did they exert so much control? I can't imagine that there were that many colonists.
Well, there was certainly a sense of exploitation and dispossession that many of the Africans felt. The problem was that the British had done a very concise job of dividing and ruling the local populations. Members of the same communities were employed in local army and police forces. So if you were, say, for example, taking a stand against Britain, you weren't actually just taking a stand against white people. You were taking a stand against people of your own community. And actually, there were even, for various reasons, many Kenyans who were loyal to the crown. Because, of course, some Kenyans benefited specifically from colonial rule.
You know what I think is wild, though? That there are so many movies of East Africa that try and depict colonial Kenya as some paradise.
Yeah, and you're right, Leila. It's a crazy thing. Like, even when I was growing up, and I grew up in a settler family in Southern Africa, Kenya was seen as like this mythical country. You know, you had films like Out of Africa, The Snows of Kilimanjaro, Born Free. They painted this very nostalgic picture that was practically false for most Kenyans. You know, even recently there was this Taylor Swift music video called Wildest Dreams, which pays homage to that time. And when you look at that music video, it's like these beautiful African landscapes with animals and stuff, but like no people involved.
I mean, it tells you a lot about how that image has been hammered into people's heads.
In short, Dedan Kamati sees all of this exploitation and injustice close at hand. He actually even joined the colonial military, but he was kicked out. So in around 1951, Dedan Kamati joins a group of Kenyans who believe the British should leave Kenya for the Kenyans. And among them are people like Jomo Kenyatta. And Jomo Kenyatta, of course, would one day go on to become Kenya's first president.
What were they called?
This group was called the Kenyan African Union. But Kimathi was drawn to a more militant faction of this organization, known as the Kenya Land and Freedom Army.
And who were they?
Well, they were actually better known as Mau Mau. And for many settler communities, the words Mau Mau would strike instant fear.
In Nairobi, capital of Kenya, Europeans and Africans still walk the streets in fear of the dreaded Mau Mau. For it is that band of fanatics whose bloody deeds have cast a dark shadow across the face of Kenya.
But not so for everyone. James Shimanyula, who has been reporting for DW in East Africa for decades. And I asked him for his take on this.
When I was in school, I and other age mates used to hear about Mau Mau. But we were young, but you see, we were not filled with any fear at all, because first of all, we lived in Western Kenya, more than 600 kilometers or 800 kilometers from the place where the colonial government authorities were fighting Mau Mau. So those were just stories that were narrated to us by our parents that there is fighting going on. There was no feeling of fear at all, as far as I can remember, when you put me together with the other youngsters. There was no fear at all, because my father actually was in the military. So he used just to send messages that we are safe and sound, and that is all. And then our mother used to narrate to us that everything is being taken care of. But you see, we were taking it as a child can be told a story from a traditional story in the home, but, you know, without being filled with fear.
So what did Kimathi and the Mau Mau do?
They were basically the militant wing of the Kenyan independence struggle. And Kimathi rose to be a field marshal in the guerrilla army. Dr. Margaret Gachihi is a Kenyan historian focusing on Kenya's freedom struggle. She explains why Kimathi was a thorn in the flesh for the British colonial power.
He was very good in propaganda, for example. This is the Kimathi who was 10 different places at once. We really don't know who he was many years later. This is the Kimathi who sent letters to the provincial commissioner saying that they wanted the PC's head and so on and so forth. And he would sign General Field Marshal Dedan Kimathi.
But that sounds like he was crusading against the British. Wasn't that a good thing?
Well, yes and no. Kimathi's militants were certainly feared, but not just by the British. They were also very controversial and are known to have committed atrocities. Not all Kenyans, or not even all Kikuyus, supported Mau Mau. The movement never actually stood a chance in a conventional fight against well-armed and professional soldiers. So Mau Mau would attack settler farms, burn them down, maim livestock, and attack and kill settlers where they could. They would strike and melt back into the forests and villages.
So real guerrillas.
Exactly. And with limited resources, what they achieved was actually considerable. But they also targeted moderate Kenyans, who Mau Mau regarded as colonial collaborators. In fact, more Kenyans than white colonialists were killed, which is why Dedan Kimathi's story is often whispered rather than spoken about out loud. Even within the Kenyan independence movement, there were critics of Kimathi's Mau Mau. Jomo Kenyatta, who would of course later become Kenya's president, was one of them, in fact.
Huh? But shouldn't they have been on the same side?
Yeah, but while Kenyatta saw diplomacy and a negotiated end to colonial rule as the answer, Kimathi, probably because of his direct experience of British colonial rule, believed British settlers had to be driven out of Kenya permanently. Gachihi again.
You really cannot compare the freedom fighters because each had their own narrative. There were men like Kenyatta who had been to places, London, Russia, and so on. He was a gentleman of the world. He was a citizen of the world. And therefore, his perspective of what freedom was or how it could be attained, what nationalism was and what it could be, was very different from Kimathi, whose world was not large, but who knew of methods that Kenyatta would not have used or known about to carry out his end of the freedom struggle. That's the way I would like to see it, that each was different, but the goal was the same.
And the longer you look at the colonial history, the more you begin to sympathize with Kimathi's militant mindset, especially when the British colonial administration started targeting Mau Mau or anyone remotely associated with Mau Mau.
And why do you say that?
So I know the Mau Mau methods were cruel and they were responsible for significant massacres, but it almost pales in comparison to how the British went about putting the Mau Mau uprising down. The Kenyan Human Rights Commission has said that 90,000 Kenyans were executed, maimed, or tortured during the crackdown. 160,000 were held in detention camps, and many were used as forced labor for the colonial authorities. This included women and children, as well as people who were only suspected of collaborating with Mau Mau, whether they wanted to or not. And this is also an interesting stat. 1,090 Kenyans were executed, the largest wartime use of capital punishment in the history of the British Empire.
Hang on, but this isn't that widely known, right?
No, and it remained unknown for quite a long time, especially when Kenya became independent in 1963. The atrocities of the British colonial administration remained largely under wraps, because a lot of the records detailing the horrific actions of the British and their associated forces in Kenya were kept classified in the United Kingdom until 2011, when by chance some journalists found records of Mau Mau's suppression. And you know, for someone who has British ancestry myself, this was a real shock. Really, like when I first heard the story, I couldn't believe it almost. In 2013, Britain agreed to pay up to £20 million to victims of the Mau Mau uprising as compensation.
It's just terrible. But what happened to Dedan Kimathi and the Mau Mau?
Well, Kimathi fought until the day he died, literally. In October 1956, he was shot and wounded by a fellow Kenyan, a home guard under the command of British colonial troops, and he was arrested. You know, by this stage, capturing Kimathi, who had had this huge reputation, he'd become a prize for the British colonial authorities.
To the little town of Nairi in Kikuyu territory, Kenya police bring the biggest prize of the anti-terrorist campaign, Dedan Kimathi, self-styled field marshal of the Mau Mau organization.
In fact, Commander Ian Henderson detailed his obsession with hunting Kimathi in his book, The Hunt for Kimathi. After his arrest, Dedan Kimathi was quickly put on trial and hanged on February the 18th, 1957. With his death, the Mau Mau uprising basically came to an end.
This story is so depressing in so many ways.
Yeah, Leila, I should have mentioned it. This wasn't going to be a very easy one. And the crazy thing is that Dedan Kimathi's grave was actually only discovered in 2019. That's like 4 years ago. And for much of the post-independence era, Kenyan leaders Kenyatta and Daniel Arap Moi actually distanced themselves from Kimathi's actions, or indeed the Mau Mau uprising, even though it in many ways forced Britain to recognize it could not rule Kenya indefinitely in the exploitative way it did.
I can't believe that his grave was only discovered in 2019. You know, this whole thing about Kimathi and the bizarre way that he was hidden from view. When did the statue go up, the one that you talked about at the beginning?
That was actually only erected in 2007, marking 50 years since his death. It's also worth noting that although his death was muted in Kenya, Nelson Mandela, of course, the South African freedom fighter, admired Kimathi as a fighter against colonial injustice and apparently wanted to visit his grave in 1990, just 5 months after his own release from prison. And Mandela spent 27 years in prison, just by the way. And unfortunately, Kenyan president at the time, Daniel Arap Moi, did not even know where Kimathi was buried.
Wow. You know, looking back, it's incredible to think that. Though I guess we will never fully know the motivations of Kenya's leaders at the time as well. But this story about Kimathi and the movement that he led, I must say, I'm a bit lost for words. When we come back, we will meet another controversial king who stood up to colonialism by standing on others.
DW, African Roots. Find new African Roots episodes on dw.com/African Roots, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I won't lie, that the story, you know, that story of Dedan Kimathi is still affecting Kai.
Yeah, it is. It was a big shock for me as well. But before the break, Leila, you mentioned a king and that he stood on others.
Yeah. So we're still in East Africa, but the southern part, which is modern day Mozambique.
Ugh, I love the name Mozambique.
Yeah, the country Mozambique is named after the island of Mozambique of the northern coast, which in turn is named after a person, by the way, an Arab sheikh known as Musa bin Beek, who was a wealthy trader and governor of the island.
What? So it's actually got Arab origin?
Uh-huh. So, you know, when Portuguese ships were navigating the east coast of Africa way, way back in the 1540s, they took over the island, as Europeans were known to do in that age. And then they use the name to describe the entire southern African country. So, yeah, there you have it.
So, wait, that's like calling mainland France something ridiculous like Jersey or something like
that. Or Guernsey, pick one. But for a long time, it was simply known as Portuguese East Africa.
I prefer Mozambique.
So do I. But I digress now. I wanted to talk about a prominent man who ruled just as his kingdom was about to feel the full force of Portuguese colonial power. His name is Ngungunyane, born in 1850 into the Gaza Empire. And yes, yes, there was a Gaza Empire in southern Africa. We're not talking about Gaza in the Middle East.
Yeah, I was just about to ask.
And this was no small area, Kai. At its peak, the Gaza Empire covered parts of Mozambique and Zimbabwe and controlled the important Limpopo and Save rivers. It was the second biggest empire in Africa during the 19th century.
I did not know that.
Well, you're welcome. So Ngungunyane's grandfather, Manukosi, ruled the Gaza Empire at its peak. But when he died in 1858, there was a bitter power struggle among his heirs to take the prize of king. Ultimately, Muzila Ngungunyane's father won out. And you know, Kai, actually, since we're doing etymology here for this podcast, I've got another one for you.
Go on.
So Ngungunyane was first known as Umdungazwe, and during the power struggle of his generation, he said to have ordered the killing of his rival, In this case, his half-brother.
Okay.
And after that, he changed his name to Ngungunyane, which means the terrible or the invincible, rather.
Wow, that's like super villain level bad.
Well, let's go further. His other name.
Okay, he's got another name?
Well, this one is easy. The Lion of Gaza. The Lion of Gaza rose to power in 1884. I think we're all caught up now. I'm even getting lost.
Wow, okay.
But he didn't know it in 1884, but Ngungunyane would be the last king of Gaza, and he would rule for 11 years. 1884, as we know now, was actually a very bad year for African people in general, because unbeknownst to them, thousands of kilometers away, a group of bearded old white men were busy at the Berlin Conference slicing up the African continent to serve their colonial ambitions. So while the Lion of Gaza had his pride, his reign coincided with the climax of the European appetite for Africa. But famous Mozambican writer Mia Kutu, truly great, I must say, you must read some of his books, says Ngungunyane proved to be a skillful diplomat.
He was able to take advantage from internal conflicts and also from the influence of the different colonial powers. He played with England and Portugal, making alliances that were later renegotiated. I think he was extremely clever in terms of power management.
Portugal was the main interested party when it came to the Gaza Kingdom. See, Portuguese ships had been sailing, trading, raiding as well along the Indian Ocean coast for centuries, but had mainly stuck to the coastal areas instead of venturing inland. And to do that, they would have had to deal with the Gaza Empire.
And by extension?
Ngungunyane, yes. But he was by no means undisputed. In fact, he was criticized and hated locally for employing European-style subjugation on challenges to his own empire. Mia Kutu again.
He was in conflict with the European colonial regime, but he himself undertook an internal or African colonialism regime, overwhelming other groups, some with violence and others through alliances and marriages.
He stood on the backs of others.
There you go, Kai.
Well, I guess all empires have some things in common.
Yep, and the Gaza Empire was not a particularly peaceful place, I must say. There was plenty of competition for power among the chieftains in the river valleys, and there was hunger for this, especially along new trade routes that were being opened by the Portuguese. There was violence against different ethnic groups as well, according to German historian and professor in Mozambique, Gerhard Liesgang.
The name Ngungunyane was also used as someone who did not obey the laws. Thus, his reputation was not that of a fair king, of one who terrorizes his own country.
And, you know, probably because there was a lot of competition and, well, unhappiness as well, let's say, towards the king of Gaza, he could never form a loyal, united front against the Portuguese colonialists. While Ngungunyane was able to withstand pressure from local challengers, the Portuguese with their weapons and professional soldiers were a different matter. So for that reason, Ngungunyane's father and grandfather had, you know, they tried to remain out of Portugal's way by signing treaties and not attacking Portuguese colonies on the Indian Ocean.
But so why did Ngungunyane come more into battle with Portuguese colonialists?
Good question. You know, Portugal actually wanted to form a corridor of land between Portuguese-controlled Angola on the West African coast and Mozambique. To have any hope of doing that, though, they needed to go through the Gaza Empire.
So Ngungunyane is practically in the line of fire.
Very much so. Eventually, the Gaza Empire was overpowered. Portuguese invaders finally defeated Ngungunyane in 1895 and arrested the king in Chaimite, the location where his grandfather, the empire's founder, was buried. Now, at that time, the last king of Gaza had already lost the loyalty of many of his own people.
Oh.
Yeah. Ngungunyane and his entourage were then brought to Lisbon. They crossed the city in a cage, Kai, and the Lion of Gaza and his people were publicly exhibited. And then only transferred to Tashira Island on the Azores Archipelago, which is literally at the end of the world in terms of isolation. The last few years of Ngungunyane's life were far from triumphant. While imprisoned, he learned to read and write and was forcibly converted to Christianity before dying of a cerebral hemorrhage on the 23rd of December in 1906.
Jeez, so that's how the Lion of Gaza met his end. Was that it?
Well, his story could have ended there, and for decades it did seem it would. You see, Ngungunyane sank into oblivion throughout Portuguese colonial rule. But then, nearly 70 years later, a Portuguese dictator suffered a loss in popularity, and the Carnation Revolution in Portugal paved the way for Mozambican independence from Portugal.
Yeah, so we've been there before with the Carnation Revolution.
There we go. And at this juncture, Mozambique's first president, Samora Machel, wanted to commemorate the last king of Gaza.
There is a historical incident. The first president of Mozambique was born in Gaza, and during the civil war against Renamo, he thought it was good to have a Mozambican hero as a role model.
Following Samora Machel's insistence, a fistful of land from the cemetery where Ngungunyane was buried arrived in Mozambique. This was on the 15th of June in 1985. Just in time, by the way, for the 10th anniversary of the independence of Mozambique.
Wow. So after so many years and a civil war in Mozambique, why did Machel do that?
You know, he wanted a hero to promote national unity, but the controversial figure, beloved by some and hated by others, didn't fulfill this goal and was forgotten once more. Too much forgotten, say some.
You know, I find our two forgotten leaders interesting in that their legacies are treated so differently, depending, of course, on who is in power.
Exactly, you know, or in Dedan Kimathi's case, writing the national narrative.
You know, and it's not only what stories are buried and dug out again, and at which moment. It's also, in the case of Ngungunyane, a case of how they're reburied. I think it's also got to do something with how they're told and how people see themselves in relation to those particular individuals.
Mm-hmm. And that part will then add new pages to that person's history. And so the story goes on.
And on and on.
And on and on. That's where we'll have to leave things for today. African Roots is a cooperation between DW and the Gerda Henkel Foundation. Thanks to Comic Republic in Nigeria for the artwork. Special thanks to our producer, Philip Zadner, and our voiceover artists. Contributions by James Shimanyula, Gloria Sousa, and Romeo Da Silva. I'm Leila Johnson-Salami.
And I'm Kai Nebe.